My name is Ricky Day, and this is Nothing to Lose But Yourself. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to Nothing to Lose But Yourself. I hope you are having an amazing day wherever you are and whatever you are doing. Once again, my name is Ricky Day, and this is the podcast Nothing to Lose But Yourself, where we strive to make this world a little bit better place, one conversation at a time. I'm excited about the conversation today. I'm talking to Michael R. Jackson. He is the playwright who wrote the book and the music and the lyrics for the 11-time Tony-nominated show, A Strange Loop. And we have a great conversation coming up. But before we get into that, I want to talk about a couple of things that you need to be reminded of. If you're not following us already, please follow us on social media, Nothing to Lose But Yourself, on Instagram and on Twitter. Also, we have a Facebook page as well. It's Nothing to Lose But Yourself. If you want to follow me personally, you can do that. It's Ricky Day, R-I-C-K-Y-D-A-Y. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook as well. And without further ado, let's talk about this episode, right? My guest today is, again, it's Michael R. Jackson, a.k.a. the living Michael Jackson. He's a playwright, composer, lyricist, and in my words, an emerging legend. He is the man behind the 11-time Tony-nominated show A Strange Loop on Broadway. In our conversation, we're going to talk about his life's work, growing up in Detroit, living as a black gay man, and all of the trauma and the joy and the celebration and the confusion that he put into his work, into this dynamic and really kind of groundbreaking show. We're going to talk about the show, we're going to talk about him, and we're going to talk about all kinds of amazing things. So, what I want you to do is do what you always do when you're listening to me. If you're driving, put both hands on that wheel. Pay attention to what you're doing. Don't get distracted by the conversation, but please enjoy it. And if you're sitting at home, hey, grab that cup of coffee, that glass of wine, that herbal refreshment, whatever you're doing, and sit back and enjoy my conversation with Michael R. Jackson. My guest today on the podcast is playwright, composer, lyricist, and emerging legend, Michael R. Jackson. Michael holds a BFA and MFA in playwriting and musical theater from the NYU Tisch School of the Arts. As a songwriter, he has seen his work performed everywhere from Joe's Pub to NAMT. He wrote lyrics and co-wrote the book for the musical adaptation of the 2007 horror film Teeth with composer and co-book writer Anna K. Jacobs. He wrote the book, music, and lyric for the musicals White Girl in Danger and, of course, A Strange Loop. Some of his awards and associations, man, they include the Whiting Award, the Pulitzer Prize, the Lambda Literary Award for Drama, the Drama Desk Award, the Obie Award, a New Professional Theater Festival Award, the Jonathan Larson Grant, a Lincoln Center Emerging Artist Award, an ASCAP Foundation Harold Adamson Award, the Helen Merrill Award for Playwriting, the Dramatists Guild Fellowship. I mean, y'all get the point. The man is celebrated. The man is talented. The man is successful. And most of all, I'm excited about the fact that he's authentic, he's bold, and he is living unapologetically as himself. Please welcome to the show, Michael R. Jackson. Michael R. Jackson, or the living Michael Jackson. How are you, sir?
Doing very well, Ricky. Thank you for asking.
Thank you for coming. And actually, I said, sir, before I asked the next question, which is, what are your pronouns? Because I want to be respectful.
My pronouns are he, him, his.
Got it. So I did make a mistake saying sir, but thank goodness. Well, congratulations. 11 Tony nominations. My God, what does that feel like?
It feels like a real confirmation and validation of the time that I spent working on the piece. You know, it's to get to Broadway, it was an 18-year journey for me from my first, you know, draft into the Broadway version. And so I feel validated in having taken that time And I feel like me and my team and my collaborators are reaping the rewards of the slow and steady race.
Yeah. Hard work, persistence, it really pays off. And that's a good lesson for others to see. You know, it's great to have a dream and to have a wish, but it takes work to make it happen and persistence. So congratulations to you. And, you know, before we get any deeper into this conversation, I was sharing before we started the recording that I saw the show recently, and it made me overwhelmingly emotional for a significant portion of the show. As a Black gay man, my audience knows that that's who I am. It was just amazing in so many ways. It was great to see our truth, or one of the many truths that we all live in, shared so authentically and so openly. It was triggering at certain times, but it was just really wonderful. And despite some of the subject matter being, you know, difficult to sit through again, it was, you know, you could tell the love and the passion that went into it. And I just want to thank you for being you, for believing in you, and for inspiring me, inspiring us, and just sharing your story and our stories unapologetically and out loud. Thank you so, so much.
Well, thank you for being there and for the kind words.
You're very welcome. So let's get into it. Before we go any further, who is Michael R. Jackson at his core? Who are you?
I am a playwright, lyricist, and composer. I'm from Detroit, Michigan. I think I'm a nice person. I'm gay. I'm Black.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what else do you need to know?
You're a creative artist, all the things, you know, yeah, I like to, you know, instead of reading bios and people making assumptions about who you are, I like to give people a chance to kind of share who they are in their own words. Because at the end of the day, we are in many ways our own creation or our reaction to the circumstances around us. You've won just about every award I can think of. And you hold a special place in my heart because, you know, as a Black gay man of a certain age, over 50, and from South Central Los Angeles, I never began to even imagine in my lifetime that a Black gay playwright and a rap artist from my local community would both win Pulitzer Prizes after the first Black presidency. But here we are with having won a Pulitzer Prize, Kendrick Lamar having won one, and Barack Obama being president. What was that emotion like when you found out you won a Pulitzer Prize?
It's very confusing and exciting because it was May 4th, 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the house.
Like we all were.
hiding from a virus. And so I didn't really know what to do. Like, it was like such a strange thing, you know, having been in the house at that point for 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was a strange thing to suddenly have this other thing enter into my orbit and sort of pierce through my little cocoon that I was in. And my phone was blowing up and everyone was emailing me and everything, but I couldn't really celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
So I did the closest thing I could do at that point was I just went for a walk and I listened to Chaka Khan and Luther Vandross, and that felt like a celebration to me.
That's absolutely a celebration. Chaka and Luther, come on now. I mean, in so many ways, this last couple of years has to have been absolutely surreal for you. So many amazing achievements personally, but then against this backdrop of the pandemic and racial violence and police shootings and all the stuff that we know. I don't want to dwell on that, but I mean, this really has to have been an interesting period for you. Is this already starting to contribute to your next piece, or what's it been like for you overall?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. My next piece is definitely me. There was a lot about the last 2.5 years that have informed my next piece. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So you're from Detroit, Michigan. What was it like growing up in Detroit for a little Black boy who may or may not have known he was queer yet?
It was kind of boring. I mean, boring. I'm in a similar. I was always jokingly called Detroit Black Mayberry.
Mm-hmm. I've never heard that description before.
But that's how it felt for me, because I just, you know, I grew up in pretty safe neighborhood, and, you know, I had a pretty normal childhood in the, you know, on the surface and mm-hmm. in the general, like, you know, I went to church every Sunday. I went to, you know, 2 magnet schools. I was involved in a lot of after school programs and choir and dance and acting and piano lessons and all kind of stuff like that. And, you know, and my family, I had a big family on both sides of the family, you know, both sides, both my mom and my dad. And it was pretty normal in that sense. Certainly, you know, when I came out, that was difficult. Mm-hmm. But what was unique about my coming out was that there was a lot of Black gay boys around me, like a lot.
Really?
And they were all dating and they were all fucking each other and they were all, it was a soap opera. I used to call it the Black gay teenage storyline of like 1996, '97, '98, and '99. Wow. And I was like on the outside of that mm-hmm. for the most part, but I had a lot of friends.
Okay.
And we were always like calling each other, sneaking to call each other in the middle of the night and on these 3, 4, and 5-way, you know, phone calls and trying to make sure our parents and grandmothers and aunties and people didn't find out we were gay and everything. But then eventually, like, I ended up being outed to my parents. But, well, my father was listening to a phone call that I was on with this guy who I was interested in at the time.
Oh, wow.
And so things came out that way. But, like, and so that was not easy.
Mm-hmm.
But
who was more emotional about it, your mother or your father?
My brother.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Older brother?
Older.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly my mother and father were not to be outdone. They each had their own little things.
Right.
And so that was not an easy period, and it took a lot of years for us to like finally be able to really see each other as humans again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now we're in a really, really good place.
That's wonderful. And, you know, you're in Detroit, and when did you realize you had this love for theater and for musicals and for writing? When did that emerge, and how did that emerge for you, man?
Well, I was involved in this children's theater group called Paperback Productions.
Mm-hmm.
And also I did this one that right before that called, that was like the West Bloomfield Youth Theater Company or something like that. And so I was like doing child acting kind of stuff, you know, up until around age 13. And my mom used to take me to see shows that would come to town
mm-hmm.
to Detroit. Like, and that was like our little thing. Like, we were each other's theater dates.
Right.
And so I liked musicals. I wasn't thinking about writing them, but I really enjoyed them. And so did she, and we'd see plays and whatnot. And but then I was also involved in an all-city classical black chorus
mm-hmm.
Called the Brazil Denard Youth Chorale that had an adult component that was filled with it was all black, like music PhDs and opera singers and people like that. So I was like very immersed in music. And then I was also playing piano. I started playing piano when I was 8. And then and my church let me play piano for 2 of the choirs there. I took dance classes for a bit. And then I started writing. I was writing in my journal a lot. And then that transitioned to me starting to write poems and fiction. And then when I went to high school, I went to Cass Tech. And my creative writing teacher was really great. And she had this program called Inside Out come into our school, and they brought writers in residence into the school. And so I worked, I took creative writing as my elective all 4 years of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And B, I worked with one of those writers in residence privately out of his house in downtown Detroit. And so I was just very, very, very immersed
in
the arts for like all of my childhood and in my teen years. So by the time I got to NYU, I really wanted to be a professional writer, though at the time it wasn't playwriting that I was interested in. I wanted to write soap operas. That's what I wanted to do. That's why
really?
I came to NYU. But then I fell in love with playwriting, like in my freshman and sophomore year of college at NYU. And even though I still was like sort of hoping to get on a soap opera, I interned at All My Children. I interned at ABC Daytime. I was just still going to see plays and starting to write plays and trying to get more serious about it.
That's fascinating. I never heard that before about you. That's great. What fascinated you? What sucked you into musicals and playwriting? What sucked you in?
I think it was that, because then I later went to grad school for musical theater writing specifically. I think it was that musicals can just do something. They can do, not that they can do more than what plays can do, but they can do what plays can do plus the song and music. Like there's something about it lifts up off the ground and like you can, it can slow time. It can speed up time. Music can do so much.
Yeah.
And so I just was really enchanted by that and by songwriting. You know, I loved a lot of songwriters and I wanted to write songs.
Yeah. And you're brilliant at it. And I'll tell you why I feel that way. I mean, first of all, I enjoy this show. And secondly, I'm not embarrassed to admit, I'm not a huge fan of kind of God, nobody hate me, but the kind of schmaltzy Broadway thing, it just kind of doesn't appeal to me anymore. I used to love movie musicals when I was younger. But your work, it fits into Broadway, but at the same time, it kind of transcends Broadway in a way that I can't really put words on. But you're really gifted, and I'm grateful that you are doing what you're doing. NYU, I'm sure, was an experience for you. But more importantly, I'm curious about what was it like for you? I'm a transplant as well, moving here from California. What was it like to be a transplant from Detroit here in New York? I know New York can be exhilarating and joyful and stressful and humbling all at the same time. What was kind of your initial experience as you moved here?
Well, when I moved here, I was 18 years old, and I like couldn't wait to get out of Detroit. Like I was so over. I felt Detroit was like a small town. And I like needed a big city.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was super excited when I got here. I was like, oh, this is where I need to be. And I was like very, very, and also, you know, having come out, I was like, ooh, I'll go to New York and like, it's going to be so gay and I'm going to have a blast. That's what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what happened, but that's what I thought coming into it.
What did reality give you?
Was that I went from a predominantly black gay social group to dealing, like at that time, Chelsea was the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Hell's Kitchen hadn't quite worked itself up to what Hell's Kitchen.
Kind of post The Village, right in the middle of the Chelsea moment and pre-Hell's Kitchen. Yeah.
And so it was very white gay sort of situation. And I did not understand it. And I didn't know, but I ultimately ended up trying to like find my way in it. Cause that's all that I knew at that period of like gay life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of hard and filled with lots of rejection and internalizing like the wrong messages. And it was not an easy time, especially having come out of both sort of the black gay teen scene of Detroit, plus having come out to my parents and that not going well. And then going into this like white gay scene that was like, I didn't get and like had no context for. And also something I realized in recent years that I didn't have any elders. Like there was no one to guide or show or to tell me anything. So everything was always a total, like, throwing darts in the dark.
Yeah, experiment. You just trial and error.
Well, it was more error. It was lots of trial and lots of error. Like, more error than anything else. Because I just was so unprepared for how to be, like, a cosmopolitan gay man in New York City in 1999, 2000.
Yeah, that's tough. And I read this wonderful book called The Velvet Rage a few years ago by Alan.
I read The Velvet Rage.
Yeah, and one of the big differences between being gay or queer and being straight is when you're straight, you get all this time to practice being straight and to practice relationship building. And you have a girlfriend and you get your heart broken and you talk to your parents about it. And you've got this whole support network. When you're gay, if you're unfortunate not to have one or two elders around you, you're all figuring it out on your own or figuring it out with your group of equally, you know, immature and unprepared peers. And it can be a lot of trial and a lot of error. And the errors can have lifelong consequences sometimes too.
And also on top of that, like, I did not fit the mold.
Right.
Like, I was short. I was fat. I was not. I didn't have a big dick. I had nothing to offer to Chelsea. And I had no idea about, like, if I wanted to seek out, like, a Black gay community, I wouldn't have known how to seek that out. And I was, like, terrified of, like, HIV AIDS, because that was something that was, the fear of God was put into me about that. So I was very tightly wound.
Right.
And, like, super cautious. I also would never do anything. All those college years, I didn't really do anything until after college. And then that was its own thing, because then the digital stuff started to happen. And that created a whole new, like, seventh circle of hell.
That's exactly what it is. You speak that eloquently, man. It is that indeed. I mean, you had to feel like you're lost without a compass or any kind of sense of direction at some point.
There, it's very, very difficult and confusing, and it took me many, many years to like find any sort of sense of self-worth. And even now, like, it's not easy. Like, I'm still like, there's still stuff that I like don't understand and I'm trying to figure out. And also, culture has changed so much, and so I find myself really questioning, like, what even is, like, gay male culture? Or, like, I feel like with the pandemic, I'm almost kind of like, what's happening? Somebody needs to fill me in. Like, what's going on? Like, are people still having sex?
Like, somebody,
I know,
is.
They are, but, like, I don't hear about it.
Yeah.
So where is it?
Exactly. And then, you know, the other thing that happens too is, you know, it's like most Western
everybody's
culture.
Married or divorced now. It's just like, it's just so different than from when I first moved here.
It ebbs and flows and evolves faster than you can keep up. And then, you know, there's ageism and there's all that stuff. So you're going to be out of the loop just because you're older than 25 too. There's that stuff, which I'm now experiencing, but the transition to elder is kind of working for me, thank God. But it's very confusing, man. And it's important just to kind of get a sense of where you came from, because so much of you is in the show. You're not necessarily, it's not autobiographical. I read, I watched, I know, understand that, but there is a lot of self-referential stuff in there and emotionally autobiographical as you speak on it. And, you know, I was just so fascinated by how you wove so much of the culture into the show, especially having heard now how much of it was, you know, trial and error for you. Tell me a little bit more about how the show came together. I mean, you're a walking example of persistence and patience and dedication. I mean, you worked as an usher, you worked at TKS, you worked in an ad agency, which you hated. And I kind of want to hear about, because I ran an ad agency for a while, and God knows how many other jobs. What did those experiences kind of teach you about Broadway and about yourself? And how did you find the fortitude to keep pushing despite all the challenges?
Well, the show started off as a monologue that I wrote right after I graduated from undergrad. And I wrote it truly at a moment of kind of quiet desperation and fear, because I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. Mm-hmm. I was so unsure of my place in the world. I felt unseen, unheard, and misunderstood. The U.S. was about to go invade Iraq. Like, it was just a lot going on at that time. And I was living in this little lady's house on the second floor of her bungalow-style house. And I just started writing this monologue as kind of making a life raft for myself to try to get through this, like, terrifying time. Mm-hmm. And you know, the piece continued to evolve as I went to grad school, and then I started writing music, and then I started ushering, and I had started ushering before that, but like then life just kept happening, and I kept coming back and back and back to this piece and finding new things about it, and then getting little opportunities to see it performed or to perform it myself. And it just kept evolving, and I kept coming back to it because it was a reflection of my life. And in my life, there was so much I didn't understand, and I was trying to understand, like, why am I like this? Mm-hmm. And why did these things keep happening? And why can't I be like them or like him or like that? Why can't I change? I need to be something else. And so the piece just kept pulling me back into that question over the years, just over and over again. I was caught in a loop.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah. And so that's what kept me in it, is that it was like a mystery that I had to solve because I was miserable.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I identify with that quite deeply. So,
right.
I mean, but thank God that you found that and you use that as a life raft, because it's a life raft for so many of us. There's so much, again, of the culture in there, and it kind of encapsulates kind of the energy of what it means to be Black and gay in America and in this moment in time. Without giving away too much, you know, there's a number of people listening to this who probably haven't seen the show, and God forbid, may have not even heard of the show. Can you encapsulate the story a little bit for folks without giving away too much? Just give people a sense of what the story is about.
Sure. A Strange Loop is about a young Black gay man named Usher who works as an usher at a Broadway show. And he is writing a musical about a young Black gay man named Usher who works as an usher at a Broadway show, who is writing a musical about a young Black gay man named Usher who works as an usher at a Broadway show ad infinitum, and sort of cycling through his own self-perception and self-hatred.
And it is incredibly well done. And so I saw so much of myself in it, although I've been, you know, blessed, cursed, whatever you want to say, with being kind of cis hetero presenting on the outside. And so I know that I've walked with a certain amount of privilege in my life. But then, you know, that comes with its own burdens, because people kind of expect and assume that you have all this comfort in your life. And, you know, I was as uncertain about myself as anybody, and lost and trying to figure things out, and traumatized by church, traumatized by family, traumatized by the things that you hear them saying about other people, not knowing that you are that thing. It's a lot to unpack. And, you know, people, when you think about the Black gay experience, it's not monolithic, right? You know, although it feels like a tight knit community, and in many ways it is. And it's also a collection of friends and cliques and communities within communities. And so the Black gay theater community is very different than the Black body boy community. And what was your experience like once you started to find the Black gay community here in New York? How did you navigate that? Were you accepted, rejected? What was that like for you?
I mean, it was basically like my theater folks, and it was really around A Strange Loop itself. Like, that sort of attracted like my cast members, who then they were part of communities and groups of people. So I kind of met people that way and in the theater world. And, you know, and then over time you meet more people as you go through life. And so, but like the thing of it, but like before that, it really was, I think, like predominantly my white gay friends that I like, those were who I was sort of met first in a real way. And the Black gay friends in New York came separately.
Yeah.
Because obviously I had my folks back in Detroit, or who had, by that point, had scattered all over the place. But it was always tricky for me, because even when I was in Detroit, and there's a lyric in A Strange Loop that sort of speaks to this, is when he's singing in the song Exile in Gayville, he sings, he sings about feeling stuck inside his skin, but also out on the outside looking in, which is how I felt. And even in around all these other Black gay boys, that like, they were my friends, but they also had experiences that were very different from mine.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't move as freely as they could. Because my parents kept me under lock and key.
Right.
And so, but then also like, and they just were getting into stuff that I just never could get into. Mm-hmm. And then in New York, it was the same thing, but like the mirror opposite. Cause then it's like, I was with these like white, my white gay friends. And it was just like, I was on the outside looking in on them as well. And it was a strange experience. And all of, in both cases, I was there like in myself trying to figure out who am I, mm-hmm. and what do I want and what am I going to do about it? And how, and do I need to compare myself to these people, which I often did and felt bad about. Mm-hmm. And so it was constant questioning of like, who am I? Am I good enough? And do I need to be something different?
Yeah, that had to be difficult. And, you know, people also forget, you know, people from the outside, people who aren't queer, same gender, loving, gay, whatever you like to refer to us as, don't realize how separate and how different the Black gay world and the white gay world is.
Yeah. But and also I remember like the first and only time I went to Escalita. And I was just like, y'all are too grown for me. That's how I felt. And I was like, I have to leave.
Why?
But then I would feel the same thing when I would go to like G Lounge. Remember G Lounge?
Yeah, I remember G Lounge.
Or like Barracuda or XS and all the, although I liked XS. But like,
why did you feel that way about Escalita? What about it made it feel like they were too grown for you?
It seemed like everybody just was growner than me. I don't know how to describe it, but it was because I wasn't confident. Mm-hmm. In myself at all, because I had no foundation.
Yeah.
And I had no one to like to tell me anything. Yeah, and so like if I was gonna go somewhere like Escalita, like when you go into places like that, it's like, are you down or are you not? Mm-hmm. Like, are you ready to go? Are you DTF? Are you like, there's no like training wheels.
There's no training for that wheels. Kind of thing, and you gotta have a tribe.
And that might just be life in general, but I was there sheltered in that regard.
Yeah.
Because I didn't, like you said, I didn't have any, like, I had very limited opportunities to try stuff out and to really figure it out. Because I didn't, nothing in college.
Yeah. The good news is you were protected from harm on some level. The bad news is you were protected from experiences.
Like, and I learned that later because so many of my friends and people who I knew, like, became HIV positive, had like crystal meth issues, like all kinds of stuff that I never got into any of that. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that in any sort of judgmental way, but like that was, on one hand, I was like, oh my God, I'm so inexperienced. I'm not having all this sex. I'm not like this. I'm not that. I'm not good enough. I'm too fat. I'm too, like, all of that. And on the other hand, I was like, I didn't have to navigate all the other stuff.
Right. Which is a blessing. A mixed right. blessing.
You know, so, yeah.
And to
it's complicated.
Yeah. To that end, you lost a friend to HIV.
I did.
Due to stigma and what you call the four S's. Can you talk about that a little bit and how much that influenced, you know, your life journey and what you put into the show? Because it's really important, I think.
Yeah. So I, there was a dear friend of mine who I went to graduate school with, mm-hmm. who was another Black gay man who from the South. And there was one assignment in one of our classes where we were asked to write from ourselves, like write a personal song or something. And he was paired with a composer. He was also a composer, but he, on this particular assignment, wrote lyrics. And he wrote a song about being like, about hooking up with somebody and waking up and feeling shame about it or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And when I heard, and he, and then his composer collaborator set it to music, and then he sang it in our class for us. And I remember watching him sing it and listening to the words and watching him. And he just reminded me of a lot of Black gay boys that I knew back from Detroit who sort of expressed similar feelings, mm-hmm. like this. And I took out my notebook at the time because I used to always sort of just write little ideas for songs for later. And like this song just brought these words up. And I wrote in my notebook, all those Black gay boys I know all the Black-eyed boys I knew who chose to go on back to the Lord. And that was it. I just wrote that, closed my notebook, put it away. Months pass, and then we have another assignment where a teacher says, if you're a lyricist who's never written music or a composer who's never written lyrics and you want to try it for this assignment, go for it. And so I, having now sort of mastered lyric writing, decided to try writing my own song. So I go away, and then I open my, flip through my notebook looking to see if any of my little ideas would be good for songs, and I land on the page that says, all those Black-A boys I knew who chose to go on back to the Lord. And I thought, oh, that's a cool line. Let me try that one. So I set it to music, and I like it, and I write the song. And the song that comes out of it is a song called Memory Song. And Memory Song will later end up in A Strange Loop. But remember, it's inspired by this friend of mine who I went to grad school with.
Right.
We sort of lost touch over the years. He moved away. And then, but then he moved back to New York and we reconnected, and he was a composer. He was writing his own stuff, and we had started collaborating on a musical together. And then I had asked him to, work as, once A Strange Loop was happening, I asked him to be the orchestrator. Mm-hmm. And then, but then he was, I know, but suddenly in the midst of all of that, he started like disappearing. It was all the stuff was going on. I was like, what's going on? And I subsequently came to learn when he contacted me one day that he was in the hospital and that he had been, and he asked me to, and he told me that he had HIV and that he had progressed to AIDS because he had not sought any treatment over the 10 years that he had been positive. And he sort of jokingly said to me that he felt like AIDS was God's punishment, referencing a song that was in my musical. I went to visit him in the hospital. I sat by his bedside. I talked to him. And I was very much in denial about what really was going on, because at that point, HIV/AIDS had not really touched my life like that.
Right.
And certainly not somebody who was my age.
Yeah.
And I had it in my mind that I was going to, like, now that he was finally getting treatment or help, or when, that we were going to like nurse him back to health. And that did not happen.
Yeah.
And he passed away the following month.
Wow.
And it was just so devastating to me, because for all the reasons that I laid out, that it, this doesn't happen in 2019, you know, right, or whatever year it is. It
certainly doesn't have to happen.
It doesn't have to happen, you know, but like, and there, and, but also I then went to his funeral, which is in North Carolina. And I went to the church that he had been raised in. And the pastor said something from the pulpit that like just set off a little red flag for me. And after the funeral, I looked up the pastor, and it turned out that he was like this very anti-gay pastor that was like sort of popular in the area, who would like, was like doing all this anti-trans marches and stuff on the state capitol, just all the stuff. And I, and it dawned on me, it's like, oh, he was like really raised with this.
Mm-hmm.
Like in a real way. And I had been raised with some of that stuff too, but not to like this degree.
Right.
And then I like, and I also found out like all these other things about like, he was making, like there was, he was involved in a lot of risk. My friend was involved in a lot of risky behaviors and all the things, you know, we all talk about, with regard to this. And it just, it was devastating to me. Yeah. Especially, and the show weirdly like already was speaking to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like just sort of completed the loop of it in the show, because I felt like it was too important, because it was like a part of my story.
Absolutely.
As well. Like I thought, I think about this, that statistic that people used to always cite from a couple years ago about, Black gay men have a 1 in 2 chance of becoming HIV positive in their lifetimes. And I thought about if he was 1, I was 2.
Mm-hmm.
and that like our lives were very connected, and that we like we had very similar backgrounds, and yet his situation went this way and mine went that way. And that just seemed important to kind of speak to as much as I could speak to it in my story.
Yeah, it's super important. And, you know, as I talked about it earlier with you, I was very emotional watching the show for that reason. Because in the 90s, I remember going to funerals, it felt like every 2 or 3 months, you know, burying friends constantly, you know, nobody talking about what happened to them or where they went, but we all kind of knew. And then I had a similar experience where I lost a friend well after the time there were HIV drugs and medications, but he still suffered in silence, worried about stigma, didn't get treated, and we lost him unnecessarily. And so much of what takes people out is this deep sense of woundedness that typically comes from the people and the institutions that should be loving and caring for and nurturing us. And I remember, you know, Michael, it going on this retreat called Many Men, Many Voices, right? And it was supposed to be about preventing HIV and other STDs. And it was a group of Black gay men. And on the first day, Michael Roberson, who's Dr. Michael Roberson now, was facilitator. And on the first day, first activity he did is he wrote 3 things on the board, and he wanted us just to blurt out the things that came to mind, right, when he wrote these things on the board. The first thing he wrote was Black man. People were like, oh, cool, hustler, strong, survivor, Mac, you know, stuff like that. The second thing he wrote was gay man. I was like, oh, fabulous, creative, over the top, you know, all those grand diva, all those things. The third thing he wrote was Black gay man. And people started, these are Black gay men. People started blurting out things like punk, sissy, faggot, HIV, hustler, no. And I had this look on my face, much like the one I have on my face now, which was like just horror. Like, what is going on? And so he calls on me. He's like, Ricky, I see this look on your face. What is it you're thinking? And I said, well, it's clear to me where you're going with this. We're telling people to be safe, to protect yourself. But if people don't see themselves worthy of living, of loving, of protecting, then who's going to protect it? And that sense of that lack of love is coming from the very institutions, people, places, and things that are supposed to be nurturing and affirming us. So this is a loop, if you will, of this self-deprecating, you know, behavior and thoughts about self. And so I share that because it's so important that you've written this show and you've done it in such an authentic way, such an honest way, and in a way that helps people to kind of see these things from through a different lens, right? And to see also at the same time as a mirror, doing this thing called Dr. Sean Jenright calls mirror work, where people can watch the show through a particular lens, but also I'm hopeful that people put their mirror glasses on and look at self and how have I moved through the world? How have I treated my queer cousin or my gay son? Or how am I treating other human beings? And can we all do something individually to stop harming each other and wounding each other the way we are? So that's why this show is so important. And I think so many people are grateful to you and celebrating the work, man. It's really, really important.
Thank you. Thank you.
And, you know, to that notion of woundedness, I want to talk about that for a moment. Can you share with us something that wounded you and how it may have inhibited, you know, however briefly, your access to joy and what you did to heal or start the process of healing from that wound?
Wait. Ask that one more time.
Yeah, absolutely. So this season, the theme is hope, healing, and love. And right. One of the things we're focused on is this healing process, right? Because so many of us, most of us, have gone through some kind of traumatic experiences that have deeply wounded us. And as human beings, and particularly people of color, instead of seeking help or seeking therapy or doing what we need to do to heal, we just kind of put on our big boy pants or big girl pants, put a band-aid on, keep it moving. But you never heal from those wounds, and those wounds fester and they show up in your future relationships and your dealings in business and how you treat yourself. And so I'm just wondering, as we talk about this all season, I'm talking to psychologists and celebrities and all kinds of people, just exploring how people have been wounded and what that wound did, how it blocked them from accessing joy, and what they did, if anything, to start to heal from that wound. It could be anything. It could be as simple as church hurt or as deep as a parental wound.
I think when I came out to my family, it was my experience of that was that their emotion about it was so heightened that there was not a space for me to feel anything. Like there was no one was like my ally in that moment.
Yeah.
And so my experience of it, of how I felt was I felt as though I, to use a soap opera analogy, I've used soap opera analogies all the time. I felt as though I had been exposed as like a villain, a secret villain who had like destroyed the family with like who I was. And I internalized that and I felt so bad. And I like didn't know what it was like. I had killed someone.
Mm-hmm.
Like I had killed my parents' child, right? And I killed my brother's little brother. And I lived with that feeling for like such a long time. That's how I process it.
Absolutely. I understand.
And I do think that it stood in the way of me really being, I think it actually created the conditions for me when I went to New York to like not live as freely as I could have or would have, because I had been told, like, if you keep living this lifestyle that you're going to get HIV and all this stuff and God hates it and all the stuff.
Yeah.
And I had like a complex of like, I cannot prove them right.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of the reason why I was so tightly wound. Because I was like, if I get HIV or something, then they're going to say, I told you so.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's not allowed.
Right.
And, you know, it just took me years of living and therapy and making friends and writing, to be frank, like my art very much was something that helped me heard, or at least to clarify what it was that I felt and what I was angry about and what I was sad about and what I wanted. All of those things really helped me get to a higher ground.
Yeah.
And then also life sort of happening, like my mom had some health issues that were pretty serious that for me brought about a shift in how I perceived her, for example.
Yeah.
And I think she also had a shift with me. And the same thing with my dad. And just also watching them get older, their mortality just suddenly, like, all the other stuff just ceased to matter. And also them coming to see my show, because I never had shared any of my art with them.
Mm-hmm.
Them coming to see it and to support me and to cheer me on and to be so proud and like all of that, it really helps so much in ways that I never imagined that it would, because I was always so worried about what they would think.
Mm-hmm. That became almost his own living entity, that fear of what they would think. Yeah.
And then once they like came to see the show off Broadway, it was like a shift, like another shift. They were so happy for me, and they were so like blown away by what they were seeing, and that they were in New York and seeing their child's musical. And then they came the opening night for Broadway as well. And it was like times 100.
Yeah.
And I just really treasured getting to spend those moments with them. And like, and that it, none of it, whatever art had happened with us in the past, it was like another lifetime ago.
Mm-hmm. Time is a way of healing wounds, and age has a way of humbling you, because you start to see your own mortality, and it starts to remind you of your own humanity, which then of course puts you in touch with the fact that you're living with lots of other humans, and everybody else is a human being and with their own frailties. And so much of what people react to, I think, is, you know, based on religion, and I'm, by the way, a minister, and the misinterpretation of the Bible and some of those things can be really damaging and harmful. And, you know, I like the fact that you call some of those things out in the show. And to that end, by the way, have you heard from Tyler Perry?
I have.
Oh my goodness.
He called me mm-hmm. right after I won the Pulitzer Prize, and he congratulated me on that. And he also told me that he was going to beat my ass. But I said, let's go. I said, I'll put Vaseline on my face. Let's get into it. But he was like very, you know, nice to me. And we talked a little bit about how he felt that he knows that a lot of writers get compared to him by their families, and that he feels everyone should be able to do whatever they want, which I agree with that, but yeah. I still have notes.
As do I. As do many of us.
Right. And, you know, and then after that, I text him every once in a while. Like, I congratulated him when he won the governor's award. And then he texted, and I think I sent him a happy birthday and Merry Christmas that year. And then he texted me, when there was like, I think there's a profile of me in New York Times Magazine. And he, you know, congratulated me on that. And also I think the show, like going to Broadway, and he, you know, said that that maybe he would come to the show and not tell me. So we'll see. Whatever the case, the ball is fully in his court, because I'm not inviting him.
Well, I love the fact that he's his own big enough to talk to you and not try to fight you in the street. So that's progress. Cause you've said some very poignant and pointed things about him and his art, and some of which I actually share. And you know, it's just good to have this dialogue in the public. Well,
and for me, I think it's important because he's clearly has an audience, and he clearly has, his work is meaningful or enjoyable to a lot of people. So to me, and I take his work seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like it can take it.
Yeah.
And I actually think it's a disservice when we don't talk about each other's work. There's always this and I'm like, he's a billionaire. He can take it.
And it's an important conversation to have, because art has real world ramifications and consequences, and some of which we've already covered in this conversation. And so it's important to have those conversations and to understand how important it is to speak life into each other and to build community. And for those who call themselves Christian, I mean, to be Christian is to do what Jesus said, which is to be a disciple of Jesus and to love one another. It's not a call to judge. It's not a call to harm. Let God do that if you believe that. But it's a call to love. And so it's completely disingenuous to say you're a Christian and then not be, at the very least, loving of everyone. And so it's important to call that stuff out. It really is.
Amen.
You know, in this New York Times interview with Elizabeth Vincentelli, you shared the following quote. You said that bell hooks talks a lot about the imagination as a space for liberty, and I believe in that. You went on to say that Black artists, our imaginations are limitless. I want to create an expansive world that isn't about just my own direct destruction. I want to do the opposite of that, to talk about the potential for creation and for living and for dealing with the problems of the world and for laughing and for joy. First of all, I utterly agree. I want to give you a chance to kind of unpack that a little bit for people who are listening and really just drive home the point of how important that is. That's a very important statement to me and one that I share, man.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that there's a tendency with Black fiction, whether it's in film and TV or theater, whatever, to sort of focus on the destruction of Black people and sort of the oppression of Black people. And I'm not at all saying that one should not or cannot tell those stories, but I guess I'm interested in what there's all kinds of struggles that we have in life that are like from real life that are, and they're things that like don't that don't kill us, that don't, you know, destroy us. And I'm just interested in like finding all of those nuances and those complexities and like, and frankly, also telling stories about Black people who make mistakes.
Yes.
And like, can admit it and come back from it. And who like, whose own behavior is the thing that you're tracking, that it's not always about some sort of like white outsider coming in to ruin the day.
Absolutely.
That it's like, what did you do? Where were you in it? I just think it's important.
It's really, really important. And I agree. What's been the reaction to the show? I mean, obviously it's a hit and you've got the 11 nominations, but I'm very curious how the various audiences are experiencing it. Have you had a chance to have feedback of, you know, what are white audiences saying versus Black audiences versus Black gay audiences?
It's been a wide, wide spectrum, let me tell you, which I guess that means that the show is working, that it has a very polarizing, well, polarized not the right word. It has multivalent like responses. There's people who like love it and feel seen. There are people who like love it and like feel like they learned something. I always talk about for some people the show is a mirror, and for other people the show is a window. And so I had those responses. I had more than one person come up to me, or one gentleman in particular came up to me and told me about, he's a white gay man, and he told me that his family really struggled with accepting him as gay, and he brought some of them to the show, and that it began a dialogue in his family about that, which I found that to be very moving. And this white woman, mom from Georgia, she said she flew in from Georgia to see the show, and she talked about how she did not do a good job of accepting her son initially when he came out as a teenager, but then that they gradually got to a good place, and that she then found herself struggling about how to defend him, and that how hard it was that so many people were, you know, she as a mom had to protect him after that, and she felt really sort of seen by the show and like and all that, and like so many Black folks come to me and say, this is my story. It's all that. Then there's also people who are like, I hate this. There are walkouts. I invited this Black gay conservative to the show. He wrote an article in the National Review about how my show is critical race theater and all this stuff. And then like there was this other person who said that I just wanted white attention. There was and so a couple of, and the interesting thing about that is that then there's a sect of like Black gays who like don't like the show and for various reasons. But the thing I find about them is these Black gays who say things like, I'm looking for white attention. They all have white boyfriends, all of them.
Yeah.
And it's a very, and I know, like I, whenever I hear about it, I know it immediately. And I'm not being shady. Yeah, I'm just, I have been watching Black gay men forever. And like different groups, and there's a lot of class stuff that happens, and it's just, you know, and I'm part of that as well, you know?
Yeah.
And so I just sort of take it all. Joni Mitchell has this lyric of, I'm just coming to people's parties, fumbling, deaf, dumb, and blind. And like, and that's sort of how I feel about it. And I also at a certain point have to like divorce myself from everybody's whatever they put on the show. Like they take from it what they take from it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of none of my business. And so I used to like read all the comments and read all the reviews, and there's some people who like don't like the music or don't like the lyrics, or they think it's not like a show tune, or they blah. It's so many things. But I know what I've made, and I know how much time I spent making it. I know what an extraordinary cast I have. And some people don't like that the show appeals to different people.
Mm-hmm.
They want it to only belong
to us,
to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they feel threatened by this idea that a white mom from Georgia could like get emotional watching the show for whatever reason. But like the truth of it is that Usher's journey and his experience is so hyper specific that I think many people can like understand self-doubt and self-critique, mm-hmm. and him, you know, when he has his experience with Inwood Daddy, you know, not everybody's had that experience, but he comes out of that experience, and the first thing he says in the song that he sings after that is, "Why did I do that?
Why did I do that?"
And so who hasn't felt that?
Absolutely. Everybody
about has something in their life.
And that's the power of art, Michael. It's to open our eyes to see our own humanity and to see each other's humanity. I don't have to be Yiddish to enjoy Fiddler on the Roof, but I understand. Oh, family, I understand all those
things. Love, 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 love. And that's also part of me writing A Strange Loop was when I was 19, my school, NYU, gave us tickets to go see Death of the Salesman,
mm-hmm.
with Brian Dennehy. And I remember watching it. I was like, I don't know anything about, you know, old white man in the 1950s, you know, with insurance issues or whatever. Mm-hmm. Had nothing to do with me. And yet whatever they did on that stage in that production reached across, and I like cried my eyes out. I felt so bad for him when he like killed himself.
Yeah.
And I wanted to write something from my perspective that could reach other people as well, but also reach my people too, you know, mm-hmm. I often think of myself as a sort of populist. I think of myself as a populist writer,
mm-hmm.
That like I write from a place of black centrality,
mm-hmm.
but to me that black centrality contains multitudes, and it's something that I believe in the integrity of enough that anybody can watch this story and find something in it for them.
Yeah. Great art is going to reach people when they need it, where they need it, and how they need it.
And that's how I always sort of tell people that A Strange Loop, we will meet you wherever you are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's up to, and you get to decide how you feel about it.
And it teaches you a lot about who you are. Cause I went in with, you know, whatever my thoughts were and a sense of who I am and what I experienced and how I processed it. But in the midst of watching the show, I was reminded of parts of myself that I long buried. I was reminded of, you know, even little teeny bits of respectability, parts of myself that I thought I got rid of a long time ago, where I was just like in this room, a sea of white faces. And I was like, why are we airing this in front of them? Like, oh my God.
And that's something that people always say that. And I always find, or some people get into that, they focus on that. And I always find that to be so interesting because it's like you walk into a room to see something, but the only thing you can think about are the white people around you and not the black people on stage.
Yeah, it's crazy. Be clear that, by the way, that was a split second for me. But
I've heard people say that kind of thing before,
mm-hmm.
and like stay in it, like stay in that place. I'm like, why are you so concerned? Like, I had somebody, a black theater writer, come to a talk back that we did at a Playwrights Horizons,
mm-hmm.
and he really was like bothered. And like, he in the talk back was like, I couldn't stand it. These white people around me were laughing. And I'm like, why do you care about them? And he also was like, I know there are no black people here. And there were black people who were there, but he like literally could not see them.
Yeah.
And I just find that, I think that that sort of thing is interesting and worth really putting under a microscope of like, why did we do that?
It really, really is. And I was so grateful for that moment because I thought, you know, I'm thinking I've expunged every drop of that out of me. Clearly I haven't. So I'm going to purge the rest of that immediately because I could care less. I really could. But I'm like, why did I even think that for a second? And so that's the power of this amazing art that you've created. And that's why it's so important.
And there's also like the moment when you're invited to clap at the gospel play. Mm-hmm. And there are so many people I talk to who are like, well, I know I didn't clap because I wasn't supposed to. Or I saw someone clapping and I was mad that they were clapping. And that's actually part of it. Like that's meant to be part of the loop that the audience gets caught up in. But like people think that I have a judgment about who claps or who doesn't during that moment. What I truly don't. I'm inviting everyone to have an authentic response to what you are seeing and hearing. Because whatever it is that you choose and however it is that you feel about your own choice and about your neighbor's choice is exactly what Usher feels inside. Mm-hmm. It's confusing. It's disorienting. Right. It's exhilarating. It's upsetting. Mm-hmm. It's all of it. That's what it feels like to often to be a Black gay man in like these religious spaces and inside homophobia and inside of your parents not approving of you or whatever. That's what it feels like. It feels like clapping on the two and the three.
Yeah, exactly that. And how we, in such insidious ways, will internalize that homophobia, that anti-Blackness, that transphobia, that patriarchy. We internalize that stuff. And then you don't even realize the same stuff you're railing against, you're perpetuating on other people when you're not careful. Right. So it's critical for art like this to make us examine and look in the mirror and think about who we are being, how we're showing up in the world and who we make space for and who we don't, because that's really important. Before we go, I want to leave you with this one question. I want to hear your answer to this. You clearly are somebody who's engaged in using your creativity and your imagination. And for so many people who, you know, are oppressed and go through the stuff, it's hard. You lose your ability to dream. But dreaming is important. And so I'm curious, for you, even with all the accolades, everything you've experienced so far, if you had a magic napkin and you got three wishes you could write on that napkin and they'd come true in 5 years, what would those three wishes be, Michael?
These are just wishes for me?
For you, the world, whatever you want to wish. You've got the wishes, three of them.
Oh, well, I would knock COVID-19 right on out. Would be one. Bye, okay. COVID-19. All of it. Poof, gone.
Got it.
I would, second one would be reversing the effects of climate change.
Okay.
And the third would be for everybody the world over to lay their weapons down in all meanings of the word.
I love it. I love all three. Thinking of the people, thinking of the planet, thinking of somebody outside of yourself. Michael, this has been an amazing conversation. I know you are busy. Best to you on the Tony nominations and the rest of your career. And again, man, I know I speak for so many of my friends and colleagues who have seen the show. We're just grateful that you're making art, that you're being yourself, that you're living and loving and being authentic. And I hope the show wins every award that it's nominated for and you continue to make great art, man.
Thank you so much, Ricky.
All right. Thank you. A strange loop is a reminder, as Douglas Hofstadter says, that we are self-perceiving, self-inventing, little miracles of self-reference. It's a reminder that we all live with many voices inside our minds and in the outside world that are calling us to be this thing or that thing, this person or that person. But in the end, it is we who perceive, invent, perform, and ultimately must love and embrace our authentic selves. Michael R. Jackson took the life experiences of those around him and his own experiences and has woven them into this impactful and insightful Broadway show, this tapestry that invites us to explore what self is, to think about the journey to I am, and shares in an honest and very direct way what it feels like to live in this world as a Black gay man. Strange Loop is the kind of art that reminds us that our perceptions of each other are rarely the reality of the experience of self that other person is living with. It spoke volumes to me about the progress that we can make in our own lives if we persist in our truth and resist the labels of others, and of course, lean into loving ourselves deeply. Great art meets us where we are, when we need it, and how we need to receive it. Someone once said, "I think, therefore I am." And I say, we must love so that we can be truly human. Well, that's it this week, you guys. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Michael R. Jackson, and I look forward to sharing more with you in the weeks that are coming. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Nothing to Lose But Yourself, on Instagram and on Twitter. And of course, I'm Ricky Day, and you can follow me on Instagram and on Twitter as well, RickyDay. Enjoy your day, enjoy your week, enjoy your life, enjoy this moment you're in, because one day, someday, it's going to be the last. And I don't know about you, but whenever it's time for me to go, I'd love to go with a smile on my face. So I try to keep a smile on my face as often as possible. Remember, look into someone else's eyes and see a reflection of their humanity showing you your humanity in return. We are in this together, you guys. It's truly, truly the cliche come to life. United we stand, divided we fall. I don't know about you, but I'd like to stand as long as possible. Join us next week. Remember, we're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all the major podcast platforms. And join us again as we continue to do everything we can to change the world, one conversation at a time. I'm Ricky Day. I love you.